So, as I said before, physics is, well, mathematics is the language of physics. Maths is the language of physics. So, if we can learn just a couple of things about mathematics, then over the next couple of days, and that will really, really help in everything else that we'll be doing, in all of the physics. And one important talk is this one thing I should teach you about math over the next 2 weeks. And if you're interested in physics, we'll see it in every single area of physics. It's just ubiquitous. It's just all around. And that is calculus. And so we'll be looking at a bit of calculus. Some of you may have seen this before, some of you won't. We'll just kind of just through this kind of slowly. And as I said, we've got some tutorials in the afternoon, so we'll be going through some problems. So we'll just go through this now. So often in physics, we look at things that are changing over time. And or evolving over time. So we have got a baseball, throw it in the air, it moves, it changes its position, changes its speed, its velocity over time. And also even when you get out of the pie, put it in the oven. It heats up, so its temperature changes over time. So what we often want to look at is just the rate or how fast the temperature of the pie is changing over time. And so we want to look at its change. And even a lot of you drove yesterday or the day before from Toronto to here, and you're in a car and or a van, and that moved over time. So its position and speed also changed over time. So what we'll look at is an example here of a car. And this is kind of someone making a journey from Toronto to Waterloo. And here we have on the axis, horizontal axis, just a Cartesian diagram, we have time. So time advancing over here on the vertical axis, what we have is the position. So we've got, I guess, just assuming it's a roughly straight line from Toronto to here, we have the position of Toronto there and all the spots in between, and then the Waterloo there. So this is kind of this graph tells anyway an unfortunate tale. So this is actually of someone that starts off at Toronto and they live along reasonably constant speed, but not quite, and they kind of slow down and they're very, very slow here near Waterloo. And they kind of get near Waterloo and I guess they found out they've left their luggage, unfortunately, at the airport. So they kind of have to backtrack a bit, and then, well, they pick their luggage up very quickly, don't stop for very long at all, and then they come back here and go back to Waterloo, so they end up safely all right. So that's how we wanted to look at that, but actually just hone in on one particular region there and look at the slope, or the gradient, if you like, of that. How would we find out that slope or gradient at that in that particular region, and at a particular point, at just an instantaneous point. So if it was a straight line, finding the slope or the gradient would be fine. If it's just a straight line, y equals 2x, then you know the slope is just delta y divided by delta x, or the rise over run. So that's just 2 in that case, that has a constant slope. But this, well, it's kind of in a way, you can think of like a whole lot of straight lines put together, but of different gradients or different slopes. So if we want to find the instantaneous slope, so at that point there, it's kind of difficult, it's kind of tough. And so what we'll be looking at this whole next period of time, we're looking at a method called differential calculus, and that's just some word, some term, of finding the slope of this graph or the gradient at one instant. So what we might do, say we just focused in, blew up this particular bit of the curve, magnified it. And I guess I should say what we'll be using there is S. So sometimes you can use X for position, sometimes you can use D. I'm just using S, so it's just a letter, it doesn't really matter. So I think when I say S, think position. So what we have is this slope here, this line, and maybe we just want to look at the average gradient over this point, just some kind of measure, get some kind of measure of the average gradient. What we might take is just one point here and one point here, and we just assume there's a straight line in between the 2 points to get some measure of the average gradient. And we've got some kind of, I guess, rise here, the distance between this point and this point vertically, and we'll call that delta S. So when we have a delta, this kind of triangle like this, think of delta as being like a change. So delta is some particular change in x, because ultimately, sorry, s. S changes from being high up here, it might be 10 meters, down to a lower value, it might be 5 meters. So the delta s in that case is 5 meters, or whatever it happens to be, and again, we've got some changing time. There's some changing time from here to here. So what we have is, again, a change in time, so we have a delta t, and that's just represented by that. And again, we find, looking for kind of some average measure of the slope here, what we have, we might just divide delta s by delta t, and we get some kind of average measure of the slope of the gradient. And so what we want to do is find out the slope at one particular point. And now it's kind of tough because it's changing, and we need to look very closely because obviously the slope of the gradient is changing at each particular instant. But what we'll try and do is keep making the delta s smaller and smaller and smaller, and more importantly, the independent variable delta t smaller and smaller. So it's a really, really tiny difference in between our two points. And what happens when we make delta t really small? That's the important question. So obviously what happens is this will get really small, so eventually in the limit it goes to zero. There's just nothing. And of course if there's no change in delta s, in the time, there'll be no change in delta s. We'll make that so small that that's zero. So what we get is zero over zero. And well, what is zero over zero? Basically it could be anything. It's indeterminate. And one way just to see that, so that really doesn't give us any information. Because if I have 2x over x, and I say let x equal 0, then I have 2 times 0, which is 0 over 0. And in that case, 0 over 0, well, we can find out that divide the x's, and that's 2. And in that case, 0 over 0 equals 2. But I didn't have to use 2 in that example. What I could have done is changed this with any other number. I could have changed it. To 100. And that would have changed 0 over 0 to being 100. And generally, I could change to n. So n in this case is just a variable, it's just some abstract variable here. And this could be any number. It could even not be an integer, not be a whole number, but any real number. In this case, 0 over 0 equals n. So basically, if you just know that something is 0 over 0, you don't really know what it is. It's indeterminate. So what we're going to do is be a little bit clever, and we're going to look at, again, looking for the instantaneous slope of the graph of someone making a trip from Toronto to here. I guess this thing we may have seen is limb. And so what really the limb stands for is is the limit. So it's just a limiting case, and what case it is delta t approaching zero. So we're just looking at the limit of what happens when we make delta t really, really, so really, really small, so small that it gets to zero, approaching zero. And in that case, what happens is we end up with generally, or a lot of cases, where we end up with delta s divided by delta t kind of converging or settling down to be one particular value. And what we do is we give that a special symbol and we call that sort of just the letter ds divided by dt. And I should say, just to be totally clear, when I have ds divided by dt with the line there, it's just a fraction. So just to be totally clear. And so this kind of looks like a weird symbol, but yes. It's really infinitesimal. So it's really, I guess, it's like a really, really, really tiny delta. So it's what's called an infinitesimal. So really ds is an infinitesimal. So it's just looking at the limiting case where the delta is not only finite, but the ds is just, so this stands for something that's really, really so small, smaller than any finite number. So it's just really, really tiny there. So this is like just a really, 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 really small sort of delta s divided by delta t. And we use those special symbols. I guess the ds and the dt is what are called infinitesimals, so they're just incredibly tiny. So the d is just, again, like a really, really, really tiny interval. And so we give this kind of a fancy term, and we call the derivative of s with respect to t. So that's what the definition of the derivative of s with respect to t is given by this symbol. But what it actually means is this, given by this formula here, the left-hand side. And so no matter what area of physics you're interested in, pretty much vast majority of physics papers, or physics textbooks in astrophysics, in quantum physics, in relativity, in string theory, you can open them up and you'll see hundreds, you'll see thousands of these derivatives, thousands of these differentials. So they're just absolutely crucial, really, really important. And so this is the concept we have, I guess, of a derivative. So really, it's kind of like the instantaneous ratio or rate of change between at one particular point. It's a ratio between some really, really tiny interval for s and some really, really tiny interval for t. And so in general, this doesn't apply just to the distance of from Toronto to Waterloo over some particular time, but it applies to any, basically to any mathematical function we can think of, and we can use this. And so in general, this is kind of getting to the abstract here, what we can have is we can get any function f. So for f, it's just some function of x, x is a variable, x is a function, and its derivative with respect to x, so this kind of measure, this instantaneous rate of change, or slope, of this function changing with time, is actually defined by, again, we've got, well, the right-hand side of this, and that's defined by looking at taking some change in the independent variable x, so why I think of it a graph of, I guess, so probably should have in mind, some kind of graph of f versus x, and f of x could be just, I don't know, some kind of strange function here, and we change x by some small amount, we get some delta x, and so it's a bit of a weird function because it goes up and down, but we can probably not the best example, but we can, actually I'll change that. Okay. Good thing about blackboards. So that's. Okay, that's better. So we've got this sort of change in the function. I guess one good thing, normally I get very messy actually when I'm writing on the chalkboard. I think I'd be a terrible physics teacher, but I guess a good thing about wearing a white t-shirt is I can get lots of chalk and it won't be too bad. Actually, the first time I came in here was just after a week after I got this job, and I had decided to wear a very, very dark shirt. So I had a dark gray shirt on and I was sort of talking, writing stuff, and then I actually spilled, we have these sort of really chalky rags, and I actually spilled one all over my shirt after that first 15 minutes. And it was very hard to get the respect of everyone after that, but I coped. Okay, so getting back to the derivative. Oops. So again, this concept of a derivative is really, in a sense, an instantaneous slope or instantaneous rate of change of some function. So again, just looking at this case here, changing x to the independent variable, and we get some resulting change in f, the function, and just making the change in x smaller and smaller and smaller, and looking at it in the limit, what ratio we get with these values. Okay. So let's look at an example. Let's start off by looking at an example, and we'll develop a general rule. So imagine we have a function fx equals x squared. So you've all seen that, it's a parabola. It looks something like this. And let's try and find out the derivative of that, or instantaneous slope of this graph at every particular point. Well, first of all, start off with delta x divided by delta, just a general expression for the change and the ratios of the changes in the variables. And, well, first of all, f equals x squared. So what we might want to do is start making the 2 points. Okay, move over here. Let the first point correspond to x, and so the function at x is, well, it's just f of x, which is just x squared, and then like the second point we're going to look at be x plus delta x, so it's x plus a bit more. And so if we want to find out what the value of the function is at that particular point, we just put x plus delta x into the formula. And get that. And we just square that. Make sure it's all squared, so that's why we have this line here. And soon we'll know how to expand a plus b all squared. And we get x squared, we get the cross term, x multiplied by delta x, and two of those, plus 2x by delta x, and then delta x all squared minus x. But okay, well, we've got x plus x squared minus x squared, we can cancel those. So they disappear and we just get this. We can notice that, well, there's some common factors in the denominator and numerator delta x, so let's divide through. And we just divide denominator and numerator by delta x. And so what we end up with is 2x plus delta x. So what I said, remember, this is where the limit comes in, it's limiting procedure. So what we're going to do is look at the limit as delta x approaches 0. So as it gets smaller and smaller and smaller, so it's tiny. And so when we do that, this delta x is unbelievably tiny. It's really, really small. And so it's smaller than any finite number you can imagine. It's smaller than 0.000001. And so if you put a number that small and we're adding it to something else, then there's not much difference between those. There's very, very little difference. There's very little difference, negligible difference between, say, 0, between, say, 1 and 1 plus 0.0000001. So if you add a very, very tiny number to something, then you might as well kind of, in a sense, not forget about adding a tiny number. It makes a negligible difference. So in this case, this is just tiny. So we're basically adding nothing on to that in the limit. So we can just neglect that. So in the limit, this actually disappears because it gets so small. It actually goes to 0. So in the limit, it's exactly 0 in this case. So again, when we look at the limit of this as delta x approaches 0, well, what we do is just put x 0 in there, and we're just left with 2x there. And so what we have is 2 multiplied by x. So that's what we call the derivative of x squared with respect to x is 2x. So that's the first example. So what does it mean? How can we get a kind of a feel for that? That means if you looked at any point along this graph and you wanted to find the... And you want to find the slope of it at any particular point on this graph, then what you could do, we'll draw, I guess, a tangent line there, but so that the slope at this particular point is exactly the same as a line that just passes through one point here that's tangential to it. Well, that's equal to the slope of this graph, and if this point, say, it's 1 or 2, whatever it could be, then the slope or the gradient of this straight line, which is the same as the instantaneous gradient of slope here, is just two multiplied by 1, which gives us 2. So that's how we do it. That's what we do in this case. So that's the first example, and just to see that it makes sense, at 0 what happens is it turns around, so a horizontal line gradient 0 is actually the tangent line at that point. And so the gradient here obviously is 0, and if we put 0 into 2 multiplied by x, we get 0. So that shows you that this formula, well, the formula we have there actually agrees with this line here, what we'd naturally intuitively expect. Okay. So, how about don't we go into another example, and we'll actually get you to do some work, because you can't really expect me to do all the work for 2 weeks. I'm sure you didn't want to sit down there and listen to me. So if you could just look at this slide, and without looking at the slide below that, then just consider the function fx equals x cubed. So I'm sure you've all come across that. It looks like a little sort of line of curve with a kink in it. And if we have delta f divided by delta x, so we want to find out, again, the derivative in this case. Well, we get the function, and again, we get two x points, we make them x. So the first one x, so we get x cubed. And the second point along, we get x plus delta x. And so we have x plus delta x cubed. So what does that equal? Maybe I might just give you a minute or two now, if we can just kind of expand that out. So you'll have to sort of put all the brackets in and multiply all the terms out and stuff like that. But we all like physics, so we all like mathematics. So I'll just give it a couple of minutes. So it's not a race or a competition or anything like that, but let's see. So maybe if you don't, you could sort of look at the person next to you and compare answers. And did the theory of awesomeness have any derivatives yet? Maybe we should have a seminar on that. Maybe we should get all the researchers in and get you guys to give a seminar then. Okay. And so if you, yeah, okay, so maybe another 30 seconds. And okay, so we might look at the answers. So what we can do is just go over to the next slide, and you can see, so obviously we just explain, basically write the three brackets out, and expand them out, and then it's a little bit of work, it's not difficult, but it's just expand them out, and you actually get eight terms, and then collect them together. You get an x cubed term at the front, just by multiplying three x's together, you get x cubed, and what you actually do is you get, there are three ways you can basically pick out just one delta x and two x's. And so if we have delta x multiplied by x squared, we get, well, obviously that, but there are three possibilities there. And we can pick out the delta x in the first bracket, the second bracket, or the third bracket, and so we get 3x squared plus delta x. And also there are three different ways we can just get one of the x's and two of the delta x terms. And so we get the three coefficients there, and the only single way we can actually get the delta x cubed is to actually take the delta x when we so what I should have said was really just So you know, it's just a matter of expanding these out. So the only term you have is, least the order x cubed is that there. So hopefully that kind of makes sense. And so this is the expansion we get. We have the minus x cubed there. So we have plus x cubed, minus x cubed. They subtract out, we can get rid of those. And we're just left with three terms here. So exactly as we had before, look at the denominator and the numerator. There's a common factor. They all have, every term has a delta x in it. And so what we can do is just divide through by delta x. So what happens, the delta x disappears there, we just get 3x squared. The delta x squared goes to delta x, where 3x multiplied by delta x, and we get a delta x all squared there, and of course we're left with no denominator, it's just 1. So this is what we get. So again, what we're going to look at now is the limit. So what happens when we look at the limit, when we make delta x so small that it goes to 0, that it approaches 0. What happens when it does get close to 0? In that case, well, if delta x is tiny, if it's approaching 0, then delta x squared will be even smaller. If you get a tiny number, 0.0001, and you square it, you get an even smaller number. So delta x squared is just unbelievably tiny, so we can just ignore that. We're just adding something that's just negligible. It's just no point adding it, so we'll just get rid of that. And also, even delta x multiplied by 3x, that's going to be unbelievably tiny. And in the limit of delta x, if we make delta x approach 0, that goes to 0. So we can again get rid of that. And so what we're left with is just a 3x squared. So in that case, we have the derivative of f with respect to x on the instantaneous slope at each particular point on that graph. The way to find that, and with all this sort of fancy term, the derivative of f with respect to x, what we can do is that's given by this procedure here. We write out delta f divided by delta x, then look at the limit of x, delta x going to 0, and that's given by 3x squared. So that tells you, if you want to know the slope or the instantaneous gradient or a tangent line at any particular point on that, it is just given by this expression here. So, okay. So we've got, so the x cubed, looks like it was fitting to some people. So maybe if we just move on to x4. So if you could just multiply x plus 4 x to the power 4, and just tell me what the answer is. Does anyone know off the top of their head? Can you do it?
4x
cubed. Sorry?
Oh, do you want the
direction? Oh, yeah, that's just the expansion. Is that?
Oh, no.
No. Okay, a few people that you do know.
It's x to the 4th.
X to the 4th.
Plus x to the 3rd delta x, and the coefficient is 4.
Uh-huh.
And then there's 6, 4, and 1.
Okay. Okay, great. Fantastic, Ross. Thank you for that. So if you could just tell me what x to the... Is this off the top of your head?
It would be 1 by 10 5 1.
Okay, very good. Okay, so if we just want x to 20. I'll give you 30 seconds. So well, that's fantastic. It's pretty good. So what I really wanted to get across there was the point is, It gets very, very hard. It gets really, really complicated to do this as we go along. But if we did do this, so Ross came up with the answer here, and we should just make sure it's actually right. So we'll change that to 4. So you probably noticed my writing's a little bit messy, but I'm a theoretical physicist, so it's part of my job description to have messy writing. It's like doctors. So, I used to have neat writing, but it takes years and years of training to get writing this messy. So hopefully you can see that. That's the idea. So what we could do is we could expand that out and You know, it would be two, so you could all do it. It's just multiplying things out. You get a number of terms. In that case, you get 16 terms, you group them together, and you end up with this. We could all get that. But it, you know, it gets a bit boring into the fifth and sixth after a while. But what we would do, if we did find that, again, this is fx equals x to the fourth. So it's kind of like a parabola, but it's a bit sort of squashed in there. It's a quartic graph. And so what we would find is that we get the derivative, or the fdx equals 4x cubed. So if we actually write all those, what we found now, in a pattern, what we actually find is the derivative of x squared is 2x. Derivative of x cubed is 3x squared. Derivative of x to the fourth is 4x cubed. And we did go one further, so we used Ross's result, and found the derivative of x to the fifth, or x to the power 5, we find that equals 5 multiplied by x to the power 4. Does anyone notice a pattern?
Okay.
Yeah. What pattern do we have? Yeah. So someone said n, so someone said u. So what do we... So maybe, yes?
Did you say that the power is, exponent, sorry, is n?
Yep.
Then
N
minus 1.
N minus 1, okay. So, okay, fantastic. Absolutely right. So, maybe you could teach the rest of the class. Okay. So if we have fx equals x to the n, you're saying the derivative, if I understand you right, of that equals, put the n exponent down here, x, n minus 1. So that's what you said? Yep, great. Well, in fact, that's actually the general rule. And so we kind of got that by, well, in induction, generalizing, so this is what the general rule is, but we're going to be a bit more rigorous than that, where we're kind of going to at least demonstrate to you or show you why this rule is the case. So basically, for the next little bit, we're going to lead up and give an explanation or a derivation of this rule here. So really, if there's one thing you just want to remember and take out from this class, is this is probably the most important equation. There are, so if we have the derivative of x to the n, and I guess in this case, n is, so far I've just been dealing with whole numbers, having n as an integer, 1, 2, 3, 4, but it actually does apply, I won't really look at this too much, but it actually does apply if n is not a whole number, so it could be 1.5, 1.7, it still works out. So, okay. And I should also find out that, imagine we had some function and it wasn't just x to the power n, but it was multiplied by a, where a is some constant, say it could be 5, 7, whatever it is. So this is what we have, this function here. Well, it turns out if you go through it, that a is a constant, so it just stays out the front. So you can do all of this procedure here, but you just have in front, at every step along the way, you have some coefficient a. You could have a function f of x equals ax squared. You have a out here, there, there. And so we'll just follow through into the bottom line. What you would have the derivative being 2 multiplied by a multiplied by x. And in general, if you have some function f of x equals a multiplied by x to the n, then the derivative is just n x to the power n minus 1 is, someone said, down the front, but you just have an a multiplied out by the front. So it's just a multiplicative constant factor. So a is not a variable, it's just a constant in this case. And in general, let's say we have two functions. So together, and we want to find the derivative of those, one function and f, another function g, then it's great. We have this linearity property. What we can do is just, if we know the derivative of f of x, and we know the derivative of g of x, then we can just add the two derivatives together, and they're equal to the derivative of the sum. So to give you just a simple example, derivative of x squared plus x cubed, that's equal to the derivative of x squared plus, get the brackets in, plus the derivative of x cubed. So we've already seen both of those. We know what those are. So that is just equal to 2x plus 3x squared. So that's really, I guess, a rule if we have, I guess, a sum rule or addition rule there for the two adding the derivative of one function, which is the sum of two other functions. Okay, that's what we have. Okay, so what I'd like to do now, kind of change the pace. We've been looking at physics for a while, so mathematics for a while, look at something else. And this will be all, this is something that's really, again, something that's really, really useful in physics and math and comes up in all kinds of areas. And it's called the binomial theorem, and that will be used in our proof for a derivation for getting this general calculus law. And again, it's incredibly useful. And so let's say we've been looking at x plus delta x to the power 3 or 4 or whatever. So what about if we have a general power? If we actually want to find out a plus b, some change from x plus delta x to a and d, and a and b could be anything. What if we want to find that to the power n? Well, if n is not too large, if it's cubed or squared, then well, we can do that. We can actually calculate it. But as you might imagine, if n is 25, as it gets larger and larger and larger, it gets harder and harder and more cumbersome to directly write out all the brackets and expand everything out. You actually get the number of terms grows exponentially. So it gets really, really cumbersome. So wouldn't it be cool if we just had a really clever trick or an easier way of finding out what these, I guess, a plus b to the power n was? And well, the answer is there is this clever trick, and it involves the binomial theorem, and it's very, very useful. So we'll use that and look at that now. So what we have with a plus b to the power n, well, essentially that's just a whole bunch of a's and b's jumbled up together. So the very absolute highest power of a we're going to get would be if we had expanded this out and we had all n brackets and we multiplied all the a terms together, what we would get would be just a to the power n. There's just one way of doing that. We have to get all the a terms and... have a little gap there. We have to, I guess, multiply all these a terms together to get a to the power n. Just one way of doing that. So this is where we get this term. And now there are a number of, we might expand out the brackets and get a term where we multiply n minus one of the a terms together and one of the b terms there. So that's kind of like where we had x plus delta x cubed, and we multiplied two of the x's together to get x squared, and then also multiply that by one of the delta x's to get x squared plus delta x. And so an example of something, that's an example of this general expression here. And in that case, we had three ways of doing that. So in general, we'll have some coefficient, we'll call that c1. And that will be a function of n, and that will just tell you the number of ways of actually getting a term that looks like this. And it's 3 in the case of x plus a plus where n equals 3, but what is it in the general case? And similarly, we'll multiply n minus 2 of the a terms together, and so we'll have two b terms, and we'll get b squared and n minus 2a, and we'll have some coefficient, some number of ways to do that. And generally, a little bit complicated, not so easy and intuitive to find out what the value is. And finally, we can basically get multiply more of the b terms together, less of the a terms, and right all the way down to the end, we'll multiply all of the b terms together once we expand out this bracket here, or these look at these brackets explicitly, and then we just get, there's just one way of doing that. So the last term, the final term is b to the power n. And so the question is, we've got all these terms here, and so just to make it absolutely concrete, as you know, if we had n equals 3, what we have with this. And so when I talk about the C's, this is a C here equals C1. And this is a C here, it equals 3, 2. So those coefficients are easy. But what we want to find out is the analogues of those for the case where n equals 25. And what we'll find is we'll be able to calculate it reasonably simply. At least with the computer anyway. But actually writing the formulas down is very simple. So the question is, what is Cj? So j could be any integer here, any positive integer. Okay. So first of all, I'll give you a little mathematical trick, and I'll go through a bit more of a derivation. And so this is something kind of cool. I think I really like it. And so has anyone heard of Pascal's triangle? Okay, so about half the people, so great, two-thirds. So let's go through it again, because I still enjoy going through it. So this is a triangle, and it goes back to Blaise Pascal, a French mathematician for me, a couple of centuries ago. And what he had was triangle, and you start with... number one up here, and then you kind of expand out and just write one there, and you always write a one in here. Now I've got something, I want to put something, have three elements in the third line, so we'll put a one on the end, and I'll make this element here again by adding, or written by adding one and one together, give us two, and we'll get the next line. What we do is for any particular point of the next line to find what we want to have, I guess, for a number in a space that's in between two points, what we do is just get the numbers in the row above on either side, add them together, and that's how we get the number. So here to get three, we always have a one on the end. We just get two and one, add them together, three, the same here, one on the end. And you can see the next line, 1, 3 is 4, 3, 3 is 6. And so forth. So what we might do is maybe we might do a couple of rows. So if you can maybe just do the next four rows of Pascal's triangle. And to finish them early, we go on top of the head, maybe if you do row 74, that would be fine. Okay. Am I right? Does anyone get? Okay. Does anyone get something like this, but a bit neater? Okay, good. Okay, well, you can, you know, keep on adding them until you get bored, but the cool thing about that triangle is, if you look at, these are the coefficients, these are the C's. Like, is this some kind of magical trick that you find in these expansions of a plus b to the power n? So remember the cubic expansion? 1, and there's a 3, and a 3, and a 1, and then Ross came up with 1, 4, 6, 4, 1. They're the coefficients you get for expanding out a plus b to the power 4. So what you need to do is you want to point out the coefficients for c's. For a plus b to the power n, all you do is just look at whatever the nth row is, and then just read the coefficients across. And so in this case, this is a coefficient for a to the fourth, I change 1.5a, I squared b squared, I then cubed, and then b to the power 4. So it's kind of seems like quite magic, but if there's a simple way, you don't have to multiply out or write down the brackets and expand out all the brackets and calculate all 16 terms. You just find out whatever opacity the triangle is, and then actually you just get the coefficients there. And especially when you get to larger and larger numbers, a plus b to the power 5, 6, 7, it's a lot easier to calculate the seventh row than it is to multiply all the terms, which increase exponentially. So that's kind of the first one. I kind of like it because it's nice sort of mathematical property that it's nice that there's this is kind of connection between the two. But in some ways you might be thinking, well, it's kind of a bit of a mystery. Why should this triangle have something to do with a plus b to the power? And it doesn't seem kind of obvious why it is. So what we're going to look at, and again, we're just leading up to this general derivation of the formula for the derivative of x to the power n. And so what we'll do is, again, it turns out that I'll just write this down and then we'll check it out, this formula, check it out, and kind of in an inductive sense, sort of prove it or see that it holds in a number of cases. And CJ, this coefficient for the expansion term or a term in one of these, this is a CJ here. That's given by n factorial divided by j factorial multiplied by n minus j factorial. So what is factorial? So I guess probably some of you, a lot of you have come across it before, but okay, we will. So maybe I should get you to do some more work. How does that sound? Good? Okay, great. So maybe if you could, so n factorial is just n multiplied by n minus 1, so n is a whole number, multiplied by n minus 2, multiplied by n minus 3, all the way down to 1. So 3 factorial, 3 by 2 by 1. And so maybe you could just calculate a couple of factorials there and see how you go. So actually, probably just looking at the intelligence of everyone, it looks very intelligent to me. So 6 is probably too simple, so I'll give you some extra ones. So if you could calculate maybe 7 factorial and 9 factorial. Might take a little while. Okay, so it looks like we've got everyone's talking, so I assume you've done it. So what did you get for 3 factorial? 6, 4 factorial? Okay, 5 factorial? 120? Okay, 6 factorial? 720? 7 factorial? 54. Sorry? 54. Oh, sorry, I said 54. 4,281,179 by 10 to the power 3 factorial. That's close enough. So, okay. So what I'm saying, okay, so that's the idea of factorial, and so factorials get incredibly large. They go up very, very quickly. So what we, let's see, yep, so what I've said is, we're finding that this general coefficient is given by this formula here with these factorials. So let's check this, let's test it in a number of cases. So n equals 3, this is a formula for the expansion, and let's calculate using my formula what C1 is, what it is according to this formula back here. Well, C1 is, in this case, n equals 3, so it's 3 factorial on the top, and we have 1 factorial, the j factorial, the, I guess, subscript there. Excuse me. Okay. Sorry, it's the chalk. And we have 3 minus 1 factorial there, so that's n minus j there. So what we get is 3 factorial divided by 1 factorial multiplied by 2 factorial. And 2 factorial is 2, so we get just 6 divided by 2, which is 3. And that turns out to be, that checks out, that's the right answer. And we can do that to c equals 2, we get 3 factorial divided by 2 factorial by 3 minus 1 factorial. And again, that's just 6 divided by 2, and that gives us 3. So that checks out, everything's fine. And what about n equals 4? So we know the coefficients should be 1, 4, 6, 4, 1. So what we can do is check out what, or calculate what c1 is according to the formula, and it's 4 factorial divided by 1 factorial multiplied by 3 minus 4 minus 1 factorial. So that actually comes to be 24, which is 4 factorial divided by 6, which is 4, which gives the right answer. The next one, c2, we get 4 factorial divided by 2 factorial multiplied by 2 factorial, so that's 24 divided by 4, so that gives us 6, so that's all right. And then we have 4 factorial, very same as the last case, and we get 4, so it checks out in that case, that's fine. And you can test this for n equals 5, n equals 6, n equals 7, any number you like. And it turns out that it's always right. And so you can actually prove that from more fundamental principles in terms of, I guess, permutations, the number of distinguishable permutations or distinguishable ways, or the ways you can choose or pick out terms that have, I guess, certain numbers of powers of A and certain powers of B. But does everyone kind of believe this formula, if I can convince you that it's true? Is there any skeptics? Hands up if you believe. Okay, good.
I'm afraid to take your word.
Oh, really? Okay. This is science. Never take my word. Question me. Question everyone. Skepticism is important in science. But I appreciate your trust in nature. And you can trust me. Do you have a credit card I could explore? Okay. So, let's go back to functioning. We're almost there. We're going to come to this amazing, amazing result, this derivative. And we have to say we have to function x to the power n. So n is a whole number. I guess in this case, it's we'll just deal with positive integers, but it could also be negative. You can actually handle and use the same formula to get the derivative of x to the minus 1 or minus 2. It's exactly the same formula. And so what is the derivative here? Well, what we have is we actually use the same thing we did before. We had 2 points x and x plus delta x, so we just have x to the power n. That's fine, but now we have x plus delta x to the power n. And well, what is that in a general case? How can we find that? Well, we found out what it is. That it's something like this, but with all these coefficients and c's. But now we're armed with tools, and we can actually derive and find out and know what these general coefficients are. So what we do is we expand this out, and again, there's one way of expanding out and getting all the x terms and the x to the power n. And we have some coefficients, c1, we know all about that. And x to the power n minus 1 multiplied by x, delta x. And we have all these other terms here. Basically, when we take more and more delta x's and fewer x's. So great, that's fine, we're in business now. And finally, we get the last term there. And that is delta x all to the power n. There's only one way of doing that, and it's multiply all the delta x's together and get delta x to the power n. Okay. So, again, we just divide through by delta x exactly as we need for finding the derivative of y of fx equals x squared and fx equals x cubed, and we get this expression here. But notice, now what we're going to do again, what we always do with the derivative, we're looking at the case where the delta x gets really, really small. In fact, we're taking a limit as it approaches zero. So it's getting tinier and tinier and tinier. And in that case, when the order x approaches zero, we get this approaches zero here. And so we get whatever this is multiplied by zero, and anything divided by zero, or multiplied by zero will give us zero. And again, we get the order x squared, so that will approach zero. And if the order x is approaching zero, the order x squared will approach zero even faster. So it will be smaller. So what we get is, we can just get rid of this because this is approaches zero. We're basically going to have in the limit something zero multiplied by something, and zero multiplied by something, which is zero. And finally, we, oh yeah, actually I should have said these cancel out here. So obviously x to the power n minus x to the power n, they can cancel out. And the last term we're left with is just delta x to the power n minus 1. And again, that goes to zero in the limit of delta x approaching zero, because that's like zero multiplied by zero n minus 1 times in the limit. And so in that case, all we're left with is just this term here. This is the only term that can cancel out. That goes. All we will have at least one power of delta x. And we're taking the limit, looking at that, going to zero. We basically can replace delta x by zero. So if we have zero, 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 they just all go away. It's multiplying by zeros at lots and lots of places except for this term. And so what we'll end up with is this form here. We're just left with any polynomial function of this form here, find the derivative of it, and the derivative of it is defined by this expression here, the limit as the order x approaches zero of the order fx multiplied divided by the order x. And does that look familiar from a couple of slides ago? Has anyone not fallen asleep and is awake paying attention? Thinks that's a really good lecture? Okay, very good people put their hands up. Okay. And this is what we have here. So this, in a sense, is a demonstration of this general formula. Getting to that is what we saw before. So this is an incredibly useful formula. So if you want to basically know about physics, I recommend everyone get one of those permanent markers and tattoos in some of their hands or their forehead or something like this, because it's an incredibly useful formula. If you want to understand black holes, if you want to understand superstrings, if you want to understand quantum mechanics and Schrodinger's cat, you need to know stuff like this. You need to know derivatives, because it's just the language that we use. Again, it's not just about the math, it's about the ideas, it's about the real world. The math is just this crucial universal language. So if you want to know about it, I highly recommend learning about that. So, I better go a bit quicker. So, okay, so what we have now, just going on to a few more derivatives, and then we're almost at lunch, just 15 minutes. So, okay, so what we have is D. So often in physics and mathematics, we have special numbers. And we have special number is pi. And does anyone know what the pi is to a couple of decimal places? So it's 3.14 blah, blah, blah. How about we'll stop at that, because that's all I know. So we know that's a special number. We count it all the time. We're looking at circles. So there's another special number, which you may have come across, and that's E, and that's found everywhere in nature in terms of the growth of flowers, trees, populations, animals, say the bears, and how they might decay or grow. And that's 2.78 something, something, something. So, oh, sorry. What are you saying? It's 2.7. Well, it's about 2.7. It's probably going a bit too far. But yeah, 7.718. And so that again, it's one of nature's numbers. It's one of God's numbers, so to speak. And so the really, really cool thing about E is we can get, another representation from it. And it's really interesting, but you can actually figure out that, I mean, we've got this sort of weird symbol there, and hopefully you've come across it, but that's a sum. So whatever you see, okay, we have a lot of Greek letters. We use a lot of sort of Greek letters in mathematics. So we have, so maybe if you have any trouble with the Greek letters and ask who, we have someone from Greece. Yeah, don't we? Yep. Okay, Demetrius. So just ask Demetrius about any help with the Greek. Sorry? Oh, really? Oh, excellent. Okay, excellent. So this is it's capital Greek letter sigma. And this really stands for the sum of. So we're just summing or adding terms together. So what we have here is, and we've got a little j down the bottom, and that means we're, actually that's really slack. I should have put the limits of integration there, so sorry. I have to refund your money. Okay, so what I should have put there, maybe we could add just j equals 1 there, and going up to this little squiggle symbol, which is a symbol for infinity. So I should have had j equals 1. Oh, 0, yeah, that's right. Thanks. Thank you. J equals 0 going up to infinity, and it's going up in steps of whole numbers. So really, you could have J equals 0, 1, 2, dot, dot, dot. So, okay. So really when you see that, that's just basically saying sum up all of those terms, the x to the power j divided by j factorial, but let j range over, look at the values where j equals 0, plus where j equals 1, plus where j equals 2. And if you do that, look at that, then you see that what you get is this sequence here. So you get more and more terms that look like this, and you can actually go through and calculate a few terms yourself. So what we can do is, let's say we have e to the x, and we want to find the derivative of e to the x. And think, well, you know, it's a bit hard to find out what it is. Well, e to the x equals that, so we have a sum of all, a whole lot of terms. And it turns out that we saw this, I guess, this additive property, or linearity property of derivatives, that derivative of f plus g with respect to x is the derivative of f with respect to x plus the derivative of g with respect to x. So we can just kind of add them together. And so, but it might turn out that f itself is equal to the sum of two other functions. So f could be f of x equals h of x plus k of x. And in that case, what we would have, then this sum would be d h of x plus k of x plus g of x, and so we want to find out what this derivative is here. But this again is just the derivative of a function which is the sum of two terms, and so in that case, it's just the derivative of the sum is just the sum of the derivative. So in that case, the derivative of f, well, oops. So a derivative is the derivative of h with respect to x plus the derivative of k plus g. So basically, no matter how many, so that works for 3, it works for 4, to 5, no matter how many terms you have summed in there, the derivative of this sum, all these terms, is just adding up the individual derivative. So that applies in this case, oops. So what we can do, in a sense, we can take the derivative inside the sum. So we don't have to, if we want to find the derivative of all these terms summed together, what we do is just find the derivative of each individual term. That's each individual term there with just the derivative of dx to the power j dx. And then we just sum up all these derivatives together. And what we find out is we get the right answer. And so this is exactly what we've been doing here. We had the derivative outside the sum of three terms. And what we can do, in a sense, is take it inside the sum and just look at the derivative of each three individual terms, and then that adds up to the derivative of everything. So we can do that, oops, in this case here. And we have basically taken the derivative inside. What we end up with is this expression here. So what we have is derivative of x to the power j, but j is a whole number. But we know what this is. We know the derivative of Yep, someone was saying it there. J minus 1. And so what you can do, I'll leave this as an exercise for you, if you actually calculate that in the first couple of cases, so j equals 0, j equals 1, j equals 2, j equals 3. So in that case, we just get 0 multiplied by x to the negative 1, so that just gives us 0. That's why you get the first term. In this case, we just have derivative of x it's right there, and then next case we have 2x. But we sort of divide that by 2, so we just get x. And the next one, we've got x cubed, and it gives us 3x squared. We're going to divide that by 6, and we get x squared divided by 2 then. But if you look at that on all the terms we get, does anyone kind of notice some kind of similarity between those two lines? We've got the 1, we've got the x squared divided by 2, x cubed. It turns out we're exactly the same as what we started with, so it's kind of weird. I think it's kind of cool, but you take the derivatives of e to the x, and you get e to the x. So derivative of e to the x is e to the x. So it's a pretty easy one to remember. So that's what that is. So okay, so that's the derivative of e to the x. So just last finish up for lunch, sometimes we have two functions that multiply together. So x squared multiplied by x to the power 4th, and we'll find the derivative of that. Well, we can multiply the functions together and it's x to the power 6th and then find out the derivative that way. Or it might turn out that these functions f, x and g of x, it might be a bit complicated, so it might be tough to do that individually. We might know the derivative. Turns out there's a clever little rule, we won't derive it. But to actually find out the derivative of one function f multiplied by a function g, it turns out what you want to do is get the first function and just write the first function down, and then take the second function, take the derivative of that, the derivative of g with respect to x. And then we want to add to that, just take the second function, just put that out the front, and we get g of x. I'll multiply that by the derivative of f with respect to x. So it might seem like a weird formula, so let's just test it out. In this case, we have x squared multiplied by x to the 4th. So if we multiply those two together, we add the exponents, we have x to the power 6. And you know that the derivative of x to the power 6 is just bring the 6 out the front and, I guess, take 1 away from the exponent. We get 6 multiplied by x to the 5th power, or put it to the power 5. So we get that there, but we can actually use this formula here to get exactly the same answer, which we know is correct. So what we can do is to get x squared, so we just write the first function out, and take the second function, take the derivative of that, that's just 4x cubed, so we get this here, so we get 4x to the power 5th, write the second function out, take the derivative of the first, we get 2x, derivative of x squared is 2x, and then we get this here, so we just multiply those two together, and we get 2x to the power 5th, and we add those two together, we get 6 multiplied by 6x to the 5th power. And so what we have is we've kind of in a sense, at least in this case, that the rule works out. It fits in with our intuitive answer, what we knew or came to expect. And this works out in all cases. It's a very, very useful result. So just to finish up, this is kind of maybe about the most complicated bit I'm going to be teaching you. So if you can get this, then you're doing really well and you deserve lunch. But if you don't, then well, we'll have to negotiate. Okay, so again we have two functions, f and g. And we can have one function that's a function of another function. So just as we've been looking at f and g, and that being functions of x, we didn't have to have x that they were functions of, that was the independent variable that was defining the function. One function, we can just, in place of x, put g, or g squared, or something else. And so f k can be a function of a function. So that's fine. So instead of being a function of x, it's just a function of g, and g happens to be a function of x. So in this case, we just think of g as just like another variable. And so what we have right here in this case, that if we have derivative of one function, it's a function of some other function. So it's kind of gets a bit of a mouthful to say. Then that's x equals just the derivative of the first function f with respect to the second function g, and multiplied by the derivative of the function g with respect to just x. So I guess it's just the normal derivative of g with respect to x. So we might have, so a little bit complicated, but again, it's just kind of two layers, if you like, and two levels. So we have one function that's a function of, this is in the chain, one function is a function of another function that's a function of x or something. So I find it's easy to deal with examples, a tangible example. And I know probably not explaining it the best way, but we have f and it's a function of g. So whatever g is, just square it and you get f. So that's fine. Turns out that maybe g is equal to x squared. So in that case, f is just so x to the sixth power that we can sort of write out in this implicit form like this. So imagine we wanted to find out what f is ultimately a function of x, we want to find out the derivative of it. What we could do is basically, well, it's a function of this g thing. So what we do is we just put f in there as g squared, and we find the derivative of g squared with respect to g. So this is exactly like it would be if it was with x's, but we just change the x's to g's. So the derivative of x squared is 2x, so the derivative of g squared with respect to g is just 2g, so this is why we get this here. And we have the derivative of x cubed with respect to x. We know that's 3 multiplied by x squared, so we get that there. And then the g was x cubed, so we just scrub out g, put x cubed in there, and we get this expression here, and multiply that out together, and we get 6 by x to the fifth power. And so this is a way, if you have kind of a layered or nested function, one function is a function of another function, then you can actually kind of do it, sort of break it down into pieces. So it's going to be a very, very powerful tool. Instead of trying to tackle everything at once, you can break it down and just find, looking at first, we're just forgetting the fact, just looking at g as it is, forgetting it's a fact that it's a function of x, just thinking of it as a problem just with f's and g's and focusing on this and finding out the derivative here. And we've got this extra layer, g happens to be a function of some more fundamental variable x. And so we find out what the derivative of g with respect to x is. So this is what we get. So that's the end. So just to finish up, I'd just like to say two things. We've been looking at this formula. And so if maybe everyone at lunch today could, this is the formula to remember. If you want to take one thing home, if you want to get a huge text or a marker and write it on your forehead, something like that, this is the one formula. Again, it's a really, really important formula. We've just been dealing with the case where n is a whole number, a positive whole number, but it can be a negative number, and it can be any real number you like. So this is, again, this concept of derivatives, and we use it a lot. So before we go any further, I would just like to introduce someone here. So I said, I won't be giving all the lectures, so you won't, you'll be exposed to some of the researchers here. So we'll pass on the offices before, and we saw a few researchers here. But particularly later in this afternoon after lunch, we've got one of our researchers, Frederick Shaw, and he actually does, we might talk a bit about his research in a minute, but he actually researches quantum gravity. So I talked a bit about it before, but probably if you want to ask any more details, if you'll get him. So he's got some really, really cool mathematics he's going to show you next week. So Frederick happens to be here, and maybe if you could, that's Frederick over there. So thank you. So if you see someone, Frederick, walking tomorrow morning at 9 a.m, he's meant to be here. And so you'll get to see him over the week. So that basically is lunchtime. So what we'll be doing, we'll just have a break and lunch. And one thing I will mention, if you sort of have your lunch outside, if you look outside, we saw the video last night, the promotion video. And in there, they talked about the old post office, a building with a clock tower. was actually the building of Perrin Institute, the old one. If you actually look out over that direction, you can see a clock tower, probably about 30 metres away, and that is actually where the old building is. So it's about 4 or 5 blocks away, so we've kind of moved from there to here. So basically that's it, and after lunch we'll come back and we'll work through some problems and some ideas, and we'll have a tutorial. If anyone wanted some notes, sorry, I have to give these out. Oops. Where's some...